I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Sandra Leone Field, Assistant Professor of Humanities Philosophy at Yale and U.S. College. We're discussing her 2020 book, Potentia, Hobbes and Spinoza on Power and Popular Politics, Oxford University Press. Field works on early modern political philosophy, democratic theory, and concepts of power. She's also written on non-Western political philosophy and is the author of several articles on these topics. So first of all, Sandra Field, let me say welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you very much.
Sandra, this is a great book. It's really one of my favorite, you took one of my favorite approaches in the history of political theory or political philosophy, which is to have a real first-rate interpretation of past historical texts, in this case, Hobbes and Spinoza, and then apply those interpretive arguments to contemporary issues here in contemporary democratic theory. So nice work on the book. And let me ask you first about the motivation. What led you to write the book in the first place?
Well, this is a book which has had a really long gestation, I suppose. If I had to point back to a beginning of some germ of an idea, it would have been when I was an undergraduate. I was an undergraduate in, last century a little bit and into early this century. And at the time, it was before the attacks on the World Trade Center. You remember, you may not even remember, there were the anti-globalization protests. It seems like from another era, doesn't it? But there was a lot of, reclaim the streets and street action and so on. And at the time, there were these ideas of the multitude, the masses coming together and just expressing themselves, spontaneous expression of what the masses desired. And that was going to bring into check the excesses of, I suppose, our, late stage internationalized capitalism by the people rising up. And I suppose I was, on the one hand, very struck by the injustices that were identified by those kind of activist movements and so on. But the longer that I dwelt in them, the more I became aware of certain internal pathologies that there can be within spontaneous masses of people trying to do things, I suppose. And so I became quite exhausted and distressed, I suppose, at that time by some internal hostilities amongst people supposedly working for common cause, and then also immensely frustrated by how evanescent the things that were achieved sometimes were, that they just sort of seemed to disappear in a puff of smoke. And so I suppose then I took a pause from that kind of activity for a number of years. But when I came to graduate school and was reading pretty much for the first time some history of political thought, I came across again these early modern authors talking about multitudes and came to realize that this was quite explicitly the texts that were pointed back to by these sort of popular movements of the late 20th century and, around 2000, 1999, 2000. And so I was curious. And so that's what drove me into this direction.
I was curious about this. We'll get this closer to the end when I ask you about some of the contemporary issues. But yeah, it strikes me, this has been, it's interesting you point to the kind of late 90s there. I mean, I was also thinking in, of course, more immediate context in the populist movements that we've seen. I mean, you see a lot of these issues being raised about, the role or the nature of the people sort of erupting into activity, or at least that kind of conception, breaking up ossified institutional structures, turning against the kind of alienated elite and so forth. So this is, this stuff is very much, continues, and it's very applicable. So I found that exciting.
To be clear, the lesson I took from that was not, it was one of immense ambivalence, because it wasn't like I somehow recanted my youthful mistakes and realized that there was no role for mass action or anything like that. It's like the things that were identified as problems were problems, but it's like the conception of what the solution was or how it worked seemed to become more and more untenable the more I dwelt on it or existed through it.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's amazing working with Hobbes and Spinoza as you do to bring out that ambivalence. So I thought maybe we could, you know, start the conversation by, you know, talking about the context for the book, not less the political context, which we've just been talking about, but the context in the scholarship, I guess you could say, in terms of the, you know, the democratic theory frame that you have on it. So you're talking about a Hobbes and Spinoza here, and it's interesting. In recent years, there's been a couple strands of radical democratic appropriation of these thinkers. And I was wondering if you could sort of speak to those interpretations, because they seem to be the kind of foil in the background that you're challenging. So maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, where this reading comes from and you know, what the case is for it.
Yeah, sure. Sure. So I suppose I've got two cases, right? Nicely symmetrical cases, Hobbes and Spinoza. Hobbes, it might be more surprising to some of your listeners to hear that there is a radical democratic interpretation of Hobbes. People know Hobbes, they might be surprised to hear this. On the Spinoza side, people know less about Spinoza, and so maybe have no strong opinion one way or another. But I'll start on the Hobbes. So Hobbes, I mean, notoriously, Hobbes is, I don't know exactly what word, these are, you know, he's a partisan of absolute power. And this, in a certain way, has some pretty strong, apparently anti-democratic characteristics. He's very opposed to any kind of pushback from the people, the people claiming to speak apart from the sovereign, and so on. He generally is skeptical also of democratic institutions. But there's something about this Hobbesian setup which actually has quite direct connections to certain ways that we now think about democracy. And I think Richard Tuck's work has done the most to bring this out. So in particular, prior to Hobbes, a lot of, I suppose, what you might call Republican thinkers thought of there being some appropriate balance between the elements of society. But that might also mean a balance between the nobility and the people. The people are just one party amongst others to be balanced. And if you just had all the people ruling, that would be despotic, because it's not got the proper balance. So when Hobbes insists upon that there should be one absolute sovereign, and he says he doesn't really mind too much which it is, he has a slight preference for monarchy, but it could be a monarchy, could be an aristocratic assembly, could be a democratic assembly. Hobbesian democratic assembly is an idea of a democratic sovereign that doesn't need to be counterbalanced by taking into account the needs of the nobility, be counterbalanced by the nobility. So it's a pure democratic sovereignty that can't be overruled. And so Tuck's done some really interesting work showing that this conceptual move of Hobbes's is carried through by thinkers who have much more recognizable democratic credentials, such as Rousseau. Rousseau, basically, in Tuck's view, and I think he's quite astute on this, that Rousseau thinks that somebody needs to be absolute sovereign, but he differs from Hobbes in thinking it can only be the people. I don't know. I mean, you're a scholar of this stuff. You can maybe dispute with me on that. But nonetheless, there's this idea of the people being the being able to be the fundamental source of the ultimate authority. Now, how do you square this with what Hobbes says quite specifically about disliking democratic institutions? Well, on Tuck's reading, which again I think has a lot of ground, there's this distinction that Hobbes and others make between sovereignty, which is who's ultimately in control, and government, which is who does the day-to-day business of keeping things running. And with this distinction, you can say you can have a democratic sovereign, But you can have whatever different kind of institutions you like as government. Or, so Hobbes thinks that democratic government is a disaster on Tuck's account, because in democratic government, people get into factional fights in their sort of parliamentary actions and so on. And so democratic government is no good. But democratic sovereignty might be quite good so long as you can have the government somehow a little bit less messy than that. And so this gives rise to Tuck's idea, which he draws from Hobbes, of a sleeping democratic sovereign. The people are always, you know, in a sleeping democratic sovereign order, the people are always ultimately in authority. They ultimately hold control for practical reasons. They're going to let there be a Congress or a parliament or whatever else do every day-to-day business for them. But because they're ultimately the sovereign, they could rise up at any moment and discipline or redirect or reappoint the government. And so in the way Tuck cashes that out is he thinks that what does a sleeping democratic sovereign look like? It's like the plebiscitary vote. And you often see these moments when he points to a number of examples from American history where the people have come together and voted on some big plebiscite or referendum or something like that to address the fundamental structure of the political order and to redirect the government. And so that's his model of what he calls a Hobbesian model of sleeping sovereignty, which he thinks is the right and the appropriate and the useful way to think about democracy and democratic sovereignty for our modern age.
Good. So do you want to, I'm wondering, maybe we should just talk about Hobbes and then we'll come back to the Spinoza, yeah. and you can introduce Negri and the radical Democrats when we talk about, does that sound like a...
That sounds fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing, just to get your thesis on the table, just as, and maybe you could say something in general about it, that, I mean, you're out to challenge this radical interpretation, and you do it through a particular reading of the conception of power in mm-hmm. Hobbes, and then in Spinoza, as we'll talk about. So maybe, you know, maybe you should just sketch that just in general. We'll sort of get into some of the details, but sort of how does the argument work in terms of, what is potentia and how does it, what's its significance in challenging this reading, say by Tuck?
Yeah, sure. So the title of the book has as its first word potentia, and potentia is a Latin word for power. But Latin has a distinction which is reproduced in a lot of European languages, but not in English, between potentia and potestas. And potentia means power, but it's power in a way which is also used. It might also be translated as potentiality. It's also the kind of power that in Aristotelian metaphysics, the Latin translation of Aristotle, every entity has its own powers and tendencies. So that's potentia. I suppose it's still used in some ways in modern physics as well, potentia. Potestas is also translated by Hobbes himself as power. So when he translates, Hobbes wrote both in English and Latin, and something he even translated his own Leviathan back into Latin. He translates both of these terms as power, which can be a little bit confusing, but potestas is a characteristically, I suppose, human or divine kind of power. It's like power over, so it's like being in charge of, authority, right? And so I think with good reason, a lot of Hobbes scholarship focuses immensely on this question of potestas, authority, power is authority, and that's what sovereign power is, summa potestas, which means the highest authority. And a lot of Hobbes's philosophical machinery is to do with these questions of who is authorized. It's questions of rights and promises and authorities. So I don't dispute that that's very significant. But what I try to draw out is that there is this other term, potentia, which I kind of, the thing is, the term itself is so slippery and is used, as I try to show, how Hobbes uses it changes a lot. So I just, for a bit of a term for, I call it concrete power. So if you think of potestas as authority, potentia is a bit like what you're able to do, loosely. I try to show that in Hobbes's early texts, he has, to my mind, quite a crude notion of human potentia. So he thinks of individual human beings, their powers, potentia, are their various faculties, their thought, their intellect, their strength, and so on. And then when it comes to trying to say what is a collective's power, potentia, he's like, oh, it's just when you promise to put all of those individual faculties together. So the potentia, the power of the sovereign is just its authority. And there's no there's sort of almost no wedge room in the way he talks about it to sort of explicitly talk about, well, what if what the sovereign can do is different to its authority? It just seems to stipulate this is potestas, is its authority, which is made by joining together all of these little powers. The idea is everybody kind of promises to obey, right? And that their promised obedience makes this power of the sovereign. And he does have some thought about how this is actually going to work, this idea that, you know, there's the threat of the sovereign sword, so that anybody who would stop obeying has got this fear of retribution by the sword of the sovereign to make them stay in line. Maybe a few people will irrationally kind of break the law and not obey, but for the most part, he thinks it's solid. So what I try to show is that this idea of potentia kind of breaks down in a really interesting way, and that by Hobbes's later work, Leviathan, he comes to recognize that there can be a big difference between what a sovereign is authorized to do and what they're actually able to do. They're authorized to have all of these people's obedience, but in fact, holding that obedience together is difficult. And that gap I call the political problem. And so there's a few directions I could go from now. Jeff, maybe you can tell me what you prefer. I mean, one.
Well, yeah, just in terms of just a couple of clarifications, maybe that'll help, and then we can move on. I mean, is it right to say, you know, the distinction between potestas and potentia is like a juridical versus or a normative versus empirical distinction? That is, that, you know, what the sovereign ought to do versus what the sovereign actually has power to do?
Yes, in the end. In the end, that's
in the end, but not in the beginning.
The beginning, I mean, this is the thing that was hard initially reading it, because you think, oh, potentia, it's this more empirical thing, what a person can actually do. But you look and it somehow, so in the end, that's the distinction. But I think in the beginning, that clean distinction between the sort of normative and descriptive is something that's clear to us, but of course, in an older frame of thought, in an Aristotelian frame of thought, of course, those things are not so cleanly distinct. If you think of any natural object, its power is both what it tends to do, but also what it sort of is supposed to do, and it might not actually do that thing, right? So there's that ambivalence between, in that older system of thought, that already builds in that ambivalence between the descriptive and the kind of normative or juridical. But yes, by the end, what I try to show is that by the end, we've got this strong distinction, which is an interesting and troubling distinction for his otherwise really juridical project of absolute power.
Yeah. I mean, I found it illuminating to sort of see how Hobbes's development on your view towards this more mature conception of power went hand in hand with his rejection of scholasticism. I'm not sure if you want to, you know, sort of elaborate on that. I mean, just sort of pointing to that here, sure. But yeah, go ahead.
Sure. So I think in some ways, so Hobbes, people may or may not be aware, Hobbes was right in there with all of these new philosophers who are challenging Aristotelianism. And I'm sure the scholars of this can tell you that they all blew their own trumpets too much, and there was much more of a gradual actual transition from early scholasticism through to the late scholastics through to people like Descartes and Hobbes, and it wasn't such a it wasn't such a de novo kind of birth that they present. Nonetheless, central to their project was a criticism of the natural philosophy, the sort of natural science use of potentia as an explanatory tool by Aristotelians, right? So this is famously satirized by Molière. So Molière, they have in one of his satires, the joke is somebody's asked, you know, how does this sleeping potion work? And it's by its dormative virtue. And the joke is that it doesn't explain. If you ask, why does this sleeping potion make me sleep? It's because it's got a power of making me sleeping. It's kind of, I think the New Scientist had this idea that this is just, it's just a dead end in terms of inquiry. And so for the New Scientist, the new philosophers, they try to get rid of this appeal to what they call occult powers. And so in Hobbes's early training had a good dose of Aristotelianism in it. Quite early on in his natural philosophy, so talking about non-human things, he ditched the Aristotelianism quite early on, under the influence of his contact with Descartes and all of these other folks, mainly in France. So he got rid of that in his natural philosophy quite early on. My thought is that its effects linger in his human and political philosophy for much longer. And so when initially he's thinking about what is a human's power, he thinks of what are these sort of potentials, what are these inner sort of capacities we have that tend to express themselves like intellect and strength. And then when he's thinking of the sovereign, he's like, what are the defining powers? And the defining powers of a sovereign are its possession of the obedience of all of these people. And what I try to show is that in Leviathan, when he starts to press a little bit more on this, what is a human being's powers? Now, as I said initially, it's like these inner capacities you have that might be expressed. And early on, he says, look, you know, of course, then that might lead to other secondary things. Like if you're very clever, you might have a lot of friends. Or if you're very charming, then you might make a lot of money. Or who knows, various things like that. But somehow the inner capacity then might have secondary follow-ons. But he thinks everybody's inner capacities are more or less the same because we're all human beings. And that's what power is. We're all more or less equal in power, even though there are these secondary further things you can get. I try to show that in Leviathan, he changes his tack. He's like, okay, power is a present means to future apparent good. And it turns out that comes to be of whatever sort. It turns out where initially he thought that you have power when you're rich because you're clever, which got you to be rich, and that's why you have power. On the later analysis, it's like you have power because you're rich, because you can then buy things and get lots of other stuff. It doesn't matter at all whether you were actually clever to get the money in the first place. And indeed, quite often that link is severed. And so I try to, if you should look again at the chapter, I mean, listeners should look again at the chapter 10 of Leviathan, where he tries to show that he pushes this analysis quite far. And he says, look, to have an appearance of power is itself power. Because if people think you're powerful, then they're all going to make sure they don't get on the wrong side of you. To have any attribute that is regarded as a sign of power is power. And so what we have is this, rather than an analysis of power as something lying inside everybody, equal, more or less equal humans with their powers that may have certain effects, he looks at social effects. The capacity to do things is much more heavily determined by how you interact in a social space than it is by your inner capacities. And this kind of insight, I suppose, this sort of spreading out of power as a matter of a relation within a kind of ecology of forces rather than about inner power, which I find very interesting, very anti-Aristotelian. And moreover, it ruins any idea of natural equality amongst human beings, because you can't say what a person's power is until you put them in society, an actual society. And once they're in an actual society, there's no guarantee that everybody's going to have the same sort of amount of people deferring to them and the same amount of people harming them or helping them. That's actually characteristically, it's going to be the other way around.
Yeah, I love this because it sort of completely inverts the atomistic conception of Hobbes. And I mean, you know, in some ways that atomistic conception of, say, Hobbes and Locke and so forth. And so, you know, we know it's not correct, but, you know, sometimes it's difficult to point to exactly what's wrong about it. And so this analysis is really helpful because it's, you know, if the early Hobbes was sort of tempted by something like this conception, certainly by the later Hobbes, we get a much more interdependent social conception of our power relations that completely upends this atomistic conception. I mean, one of the things I wanted to follow up on power, I've often that chapter in Leviathan is wonderful, and you know, it just raises so many questions. One of the questions I had was about maybe you say there's a sort of a social conception of power that emerges in Hobbes's later work. One of the things I wonder is about, you know, our desire for power. And, you know, the way that Hobbes describes it is often in terms of, right, to achieve power in order to, right, have that stuff in order to stay alive. But sometimes the way he describes it is that power is in some way good for its own sake. You know, when he talks about people who seek honor, for example, you know, love to contemplate their own power. And this is what in chapter 13, the famous chapter 13 on the state of nature. I just didn't know if there was some, you know, some root in those two different kind of conceptions of why we seek power, or if that's, you know, if that's in some way, you know, has some purchase in this new social ontology that you see that Hobbes is developing here.
Yeah. So if I've understood your question correctly, we have on the one hand some model of you seek, chapter 9 or something, where it's like you seek power after because you're never sure you're going to be okay, so you keep on grabbing for more power. That's one kind of theory we have in Leviathan. The later one is some people just love honor and love, you know, this sort of stuff. And so I do think that at least my account offers a way to think of these two things together. And so I think on the early text, you have an idea, there's power and honor is when somebody recognizes power and behaves accordingly. And glory is that nice feeling you get when you're aware of your own power, okay? And so the primary thing is power. And no amount of honoring or glorying can change that underlying power. It just is what it is, right? Because it's your inner faculties. The interesting thing on this later notion of power is the honoring changes your underlying power, right? So suppose I give a good podcast and then people are like, wow, that was a good podcast. That actually makes a difference to me and my capacity to do things in the world. And so because power that counts as a new power, maybe use a less personal example. I think in Hobbes, he has this idea that, in his early view, if somebody honors you when you're actually an idiot because they misunderstood and thought you were good at something, then that doesn't change the fact that you're an idiot and you're not good at something, right? And so it doesn't change your power. Whereas on his later view, if somebody honors you, whether because they mistakenly thought you weren't an idiot or because they may have no opinion on whether you're an idiot or not, but they notice other people are hanging around with you or whatever, or because they're afraid of you or whatever it may be, with or without good reason. The fact that they honor you, honoring meaning behaving, you know, judging somebody to have power and behaving accordingly, it means they're going to defer to you and sort of smooth the way for you or not get in your way or help you out. And so honoring creates more power rather than just recognizing a static power. And so I think this shows an interesting bridge between the two cases that you had. So that, and I don't know, I haven't kind of thought this through fully, but maybe to the sort of more recognition kind of considerations. If, I mean, it's no good. Hobbes has this nice example. He says, science is but small power because not eminent. And the idea is it doesn't matter if you've got the cleverest capacity in the world to modify nature and understand nature. If there's a mob in the street who are going to, like, you know, throw mud on your house, it doesn't matter, right? So the fact of being honored, in fact, is a constituent part of your power rather than just recognizing a prior power. And so back to your initial question, you want power because you don't know if you're going to be okay in the future. But part of that is probably going to be wanting people to treat you with respect, because one of the biggest things that determines whether or not you can do what you want to do in future is whether people treat you with respect or whether they just sort of block your way and deride you and cause trouble for you. And so the love of honor, of course, there's going to be different personalities, and some people are going to have an excessive love of honor. But love, it's not, on the early account, you could criticize people for wanting more honor than they're due. Whereas here, it's like, if I want my colleagues to respect me at work, that has a, you know, that that's because I'm trying to constitute a power, like a power of for myself, whereby I can get by in my life and keep on going, rather than trying to claim something illegitimate because that honor is supposed to only be recognizing something inner. There's the idea, when people, you think about it, when are people deferential to other people? It's often in virtue, not of some, sometimes in virtue of some intrinsic goodness or badness of the person, but sometimes just in virtue of that person's position and what they might or might not be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. So I want to see if you could, you know, now draw this bridge then between, you know, Hobbes's account of power and back to the, you know, what kind of implications it has for democratic theory, you know, how this amounts to, you know, a challenge to the Tuck view. I mean, the Tuck view is stuck in that early Hobbes, right? Is this sort of scholastic type of view?
Very much so. In my view, very much so. And I have great respect for his work, but I do think it is. Now, the first curious thing that you might notice is this central thing that Tuck is very interested in, the sleeping sovereign, is not really there in Leviathan. It's mentioned in De Quae, which is the middle text, but it kind of disappears. And Tuck's explanation is just strategic in terms of who Leviathan was being presented to, whose toes he didn't want to step on, blah, blah. But on my account, there's a much deeper reason, right? So let me try to explain that. So remember, Tuck's view is you have a democratic sovereign, then you can have whatever government you like, but then the democratic sovereign can rise up. And this relies on this nice distinction between sovereignty and government. I suppose my point is that what I see as Hobbes' later analysis of power, this clean distinction is going to collapse between sovereignty and government for reasons I'll explain in a moment. And so it's no longer useful to appeal to a sleeping sovereign as some, you know, deep expression of popular power. So let me try to explain how that works. So let's think on Tuck's view, the people have the authority, but on a day-to-day basis, they don't exercise it. They let the government exercise it. But when they get grumpy, they rise up and have, you know, characteristically for Tuck, through some plebiscite or referendum, they express their opinion or constitutional something or other, constitutional moment in this American idiom. They express themselves, and that brings the government back into line. And Tuck adds, he says, oh, look, some people think, well, the people won't do this very well. But if you look, what they've actually asked for demanded through these plebiscites is generally very reasonable and mild. And that's what Tuck says. So let's think, if we now have this problem that I've tried to sketch, where it's one thing to say the sovereign has authority, it's another question what their concrete power is. And it's a big challenge. The challenge is to see how you can make their actual harnessing of people's obedience match with what they're entitled to. Now, this arises because if people's power is this sort of socially emergent power and to do with networks of allegiance and people deferring to each other and not. It can be very, the power relations can be very unevenly distributed within a society, you know, whatever the, putting aside what the sovereignty is. You know, you can imagine rich people, to take a pretty obvious example, are going to have a lot more people, clients and others hoping to get some benefit and not get in the way of the rich are going to, you know, fall in line with them. You have the powerful towns, you have the charismatic speakers, you have a whole lot of potential sort of informal sort of agglomerations within the body politic, so that when a sovereign says, here is my ruling, then on Hobbes's original view, then everybody will fall in line because they're all individually atomized. None of them has the power to fight back. So they just fall in line with whatever the law is. If everybody in the civil society is not sort of, if people already have these sort of informal groupings and structures of deference and everyday patterns of trying to be on the right side of such and such powerful person, but not caring about so and so because they're kind of, you know, well, their interests are less important because they can't bite back, then you end up with this situation where sovereign can make a ruling. Then if it annoys certain powerful figures in society, they might challenge the sovereign. And indeed, I kind of think this is what Hobbes starts to see when he's like talking about the English Civil War and the behemoth and various incidents through the Civil War where the sovereign tries to say, here is the law, but there's actually forces in society that can cause trouble and say, I don't want to abide by that. Okay, so I'm getting a, let me try to link this back to the question of implications for democratic view. The first implication is it's going to be a challenge for the sovereign to have people actually abiding by the sovereign's rule. That's even when the sovereign is a continuing everyday sovereign who's in charge of trying to make laws all the time. This gets even worse when you think about Tuck's sleeping sovereign, because if you've got a sleeping sovereign, that means all of the normal circuits of deference, obedience, practices and patterns of behavior and people you've got to watch out for and people you're indebted to, that all operates, keeps on operating. And then the sovereign comes up and makes some demand. Well, then people are in a situation where they've got to decide, do they listen to this sovereign who's just come up and said, I have the authority, or do they keep on going where they know their sort of skin is tied in with their particular patterns of everyday behavior and their particular people who they owe favors to and so on. And I think Hobbes himself sees that there's, you know, this is a quite a seditious risk. Imagine he's got this one case of a sleeping, or another case of a sovereign is like a sovereign who's imprisoned, right? And he says the sovereign still stays sovereign even though they're imprisoned. And then when the sovereign comes back again, then the sovereign can be in charge again. Well, you can imagine that might work if it's not too long, but if the sovereign comes back after a very long time, you can have half the society who've got more allegiance to whatever the government is than to the sovereign. And so I think for this reason, this idea that you can just have an in principle authority pop up and demand obedience at whatever time it pleases is quite... is from Hobbes's point of view risky because it divides allegiances. But even when it's not risky, it's really deflationary for popular power. Remember, Tuck said, oh, look, in practice, popular plebiscites never ask for anything too disruptive. On this later Hobbesian view, there's a reason for that. Aware of this problem that if the popular sovereign comes up and claims something which is totally against the established order, this is going to cause all sorts of, it's going to be hard to make that fly. And so for that reason, I think often plebiscites don't push too hard. Often plebiscites are held at the point when you're pretty close to having consensus about something anyhow. You don't push something, don't exert popular power strongly against some existing order in any case. I think, for example, of even the most contentious plebiscites like the Irish plebiscite on abortion, they waited a long time until there was, they're very cautious not to, you know, if they brought it up 30 years ago, they wouldn't have got anywhere with it. Yeah. So to bring that together, I think that the idea of an in-principle authority or of the people becomes so abstract as to be sort of almost, I mean, from Hobbes's point of view, sort of a dangerous distraction and division. But I think from our point of view, a bit of a, it's, I mean, to say that this is powerful to me seems to misunderstand how, you know, what it means to say something is actually influential and powerful. Just because you come up and say you're a big sovereign, they're so constrained in what it can actually achieve, a big plebiscite. I think that we will be better served to think about those more everyday processes and the everyday intimate ways in which they either reproduce sort of hierarchies and such, or whether they actually produce a more equal order. That's where I think our focus should be as democratic theorists.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. Cause it sort of gets into my next question, which is about, well, I mean, suppose Tuck were to say something like, well, let me change the title of my book to The Awake Sovereign. Like, you know, is the problem that about the sleepiness of the sovereign for you, that is that, you know, the sovereign sort of emerges and then goes to sleep and so is not aware of the power. So it seems to me, I mean, at least following your argument in your book, is that, you know, for Hobbes, you know, the late Hobbes comes to solve this problem, or at least manage these power relationships that the sovereign does for Hobbes through what you call repressive egalitarianism. It's sort of to you know, equalize society through form of repression. You can speak to that, what exactly you mean by that. But in some ways I could imagine Tuck saying, you know, getting behind that and say, okay, sure, you know, a democratic will sovereign can still do that. Right.
Yeah.
So maybe the issue with Tuck on is not the radical democratic side, but maybe is the sleepiness side. Is that, I don't know.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So, yeah, but I think that makes it rather less palatable, maybe I can explain
right.
Why. So, yeah, certainly I think the idea of the sleeping sovereign, that there's something that if only we have people rising up from time to time with big plebiscites, that shows the people are in control. That, to me, that's a very weak form of power in terms of actually what it brings about. But I also worry about how popular it is. And maybe that, so even if, I mean, I don't know exactly what you're meaning by an awake sovereign, but maybe there's a few possibilities here that if the idea is that, so you have some sort of maybe more permanent sort of plebiscitary kind of, you know, mass vote sort of thing, which somehow overcomes, you know, sort of instead of, I mean, I suppose there's two things. If it's a mass vote thing, somehow somewhat displacing some of those other mechanisms of government, or at least sort of subordinating them in a more active day-to-day way. Okay, then if that's the case, that does sound like at least there it would be clearer that this sovereign is actually, you know, it's the one that has power, right? But I still have a question about how popular that power would be, for reasons that I'll try to explain. I mean, notoriously, Rousseau was dead against factions, right? So when Rousseau thinks about democracy, he thinks about everybody having to have their own separate opinion. And then when you vote it all together with no deliberation, then you get something meaningful, right? Whereas if there's sort of factions and stuff, then it's all sort of skewed and the outcome is not very meaningful. And so I think Tuck, it holds to that. And so he's got this idea, there's something really valuable about mass votes because they don't get into all the horse trading and the messiness of deliberation. So somehow they're a purer expression. Mm-hmm. But to me, this... you know, I could, if that was a point taken in isolation, maybe, but just think of all of the factors that go into plebiscitary voting and go into opinion formation at a mass level. In the opening to my book, I rely a little bit on Schumpeter, and I really take this Schumpeterian point that that we can see sociologically how certain, while there's always going to be some sort of ideological diversity, we can see how certain opinions are propagated, cultivated, you know, incentivized, and certain cleavages emerge through a whole lot of process, but including the actions of sort of interested political agents. I mean, to give a crude example, which I hope is not too controversial, in the Brexit decision, there were the, you know, all sorts of questionable advertising going around, influencing people's decisions. And so the idea that just because it's a big vote without some decision deliberation means that it's some pure and equal expression of the will of the people as though it's untainted by anything seems to me to be quite problematic, right? And so in particular, to link back to what I said earlier, if you have an idea of the social domain of not being one of equal citizens, but they're equal citizens who are enmeshed in all sorts of I call them sort of oligarchic blocks, where you're either in terms of your material interests or in terms of your ideas, you're sort of enmeshed in certain sort of senses of power of, you know, you don't want to get on the wrong side of your boss, or you're sort of captive to a certain news channel or so on. So it seems like there are so many ways in which the expression of popular will through plebiscites, maybe when it's really big, fundamental, non-technical issues, which are right down to morality, and somebody else has already done the work to give the sort of different policy outcomes, like the Irish abortion referendum, maybe then that's something meaningful. But you think about the Brexit example, you think of the history of how many plebiscites actually are either explicitly, well, not explicitly, but transparently tainted by the way they've been set up. I mean, from my own country, Australia, there was a vote about whether Australia should become a republic in 1999 or so, but the Prime Minister of the day was a monarchist. So he cleverly set up the questions as being between should Australia remain part of the Commonwealth and have the Queen as the head of state, or should Australia get an American-style president? And people are like, oh, no, we don't want an American-style president. And so I think, and I can, I'm currently
in Singapore.
Exactly. I mean, maybe that, I don't know how your American audience, from that point of view, it was obvious nobody wanted the American political system, right? So everybody voted against it. In Singapore, they had a vote, to merge with Malaysia at the time of decolonization. And this was by, I mean, I cited in my book, one of the politicians involved subsequently had a giggle about how they rigged it so that all three options on the ballot plus spoiled ballots all managed to vote for, you know, ended up voting for merger with Malaysia. So it seems like the idea that these plebiscitary things are automatically and readily some voice of the people, especially when they're on more complicated issues and not fundamental once in a generation moral issues, seems to me to be just mistaken.
Yeah,
progressive egalitarianism, but I'll see if you want me to.
Could speak to that. I mean, it seems all very right to me. I mean, I don't know the tuck work all that well, because it strikes me that it would suffer from the kind of objections from, say, participatory and deliberative democratic critics that you sort of take up in the second half and in Spinoza. But yeah, I mean, maybe this is a sort of last point on it, because I want to move over to Spinoza. But, you know, it strikes me that there's something like the I don't know, even like the Thomas Jefferson approach to thinking about, what's his favorite famous line, right? I'm embarrassed now in my Americanness. It's sort of, occasionally the tree of liberty has to be quenched with blood of patriots or something. You know, like the idea is that occasionally people have to rise up against the government. And, you know, he has a very participatory, like ward Republican view, you know, local participatory action at the local level. So, I mean, I can understand, you know, there's some way in which you can, if you're a, you know, sort of Hobbesian Democrat, you would want to look for ways in order to, if you want to Demos in charge, you need to do some work, right, in making sure that that needs to be cultivated and maintained, and oligarchic systems and structures need to be crushed and so forth and so on, right? So that's
democratic egalitarianism, repressive egalitarianism,
right? Okay. I mean, so ultimately, I guess that's what I'm pointing to. I'm wondering if there's a form of democracy, radical democracy, that could be compatible with this kind of repressive egalitarianism.
So I suppose in the end, I suppose it's important for where I go later in the book that the resolution isn't that Hobbes has no idea what he's talking about, which is sometimes the Spinozist read of Hobbes, right? Mm-hmm. Sure, he focuses a lot on the juridical question of authority, but what I try to show is by the later works, he's not stupid about the material conditions for this to work. And in particular, in his hands, I've been quite indebted to the work of Geoffrey Church, who talks about Hobbes's approach to the churches, which is that, you know, all of these old seats of power have to be crushed. And then you can have a functioning democratic order that's not unstable. You know, you get rid of, you sort of crush all, if everybody is just equal individuals, then democracy can work. The problem is unequal informal power relations keep on emerging. But so your job is, to the extent possible, to keep people as isolated equal citizens. Then you can rule well for the common good, because there's nobody, you're not having to fight against, you know, the rich landlords or the whatever else you may have in society. And so I do think it was important to, Spinozists also often say, oh, Hobbes, he just thinks about juridical questions of right, and he doesn't realize that that's all going to backfire on him. But I feel like Singapore is the Hobbesian repressive egalitarian society, right? We have a democratic political order, which is intensely intolerant of organized civil society or oppositional groupings. And it delivers pretty well for the citizenry, but it is a certain model of government, part of its way of its operating is by shutting down sort of that sort of collective pushback that we normally associate with democracy in other formats.
Yeah, that's good. That's a helpful example. So let's switch over to Spinoza as there's several things to talk about here. I mean, one of the things I liked is the way in which you brought Spinoza closer to Hobbes than we might expect, right? Mm. That Spinoza is much more aware of the problems that Hobbes raises, and is much more thoroughgoing in his engagement with the problems that Hobbes raised than we've expected. So that I think that'd be great to talk about. I mean, but maybe again, we could just start by sketching the radical democratic reading of Spinoza from Antonio Negri, I don't want to take too long on this, but this sort of give your reading about where it kind of goes astray.
Yeah, sure. So the Negri reading is one of these funny sort of crossover scholarly popular successes. So the book by Antonio Negri was written. This is a very, very dense book about Spinoza. But then he later wrote, in collaborations with Michael Hart, these books, Empire, Multitude, and various other things, which had huge popular success. And they all referred back to their foundation as being in Negri's book about Spinoza. So this is kind of how it propagated out to my undergraduate, student movement kind of self, that I became aware of this sort of stuff. But so what does Negri do with Spinoza? So Negri, I don't know how much people know about Spinoza. Spinoza kind of, he's got two political works. One of them is called The Theological Political Treatise, and the other one's called The Political Treatise. A bit confusing. People often call them TTP and TP to be a bit less, but I don't know if that's more or less confusing for you. In the first book, there's a lot of stuff about biblical criticism, but towards the end of the book, he comes to questions of political theory, and he basically gives a pretty Hobbesian setup of how politics works. But then in the next chapter, he's like, well, that would all be fine in theory, but it's not going to work because everyone knows that the biggest source of trouble for any political order is not external enemies, but dissent from within. And the problem lies in the fact that Hobbes thought you can hand over your power to a sovereign, absolutely. But the thing is, you just can't. The you know, your own power remains your own power. You just, there's a limit that there's all sorts of ways that you can be, get hand over your power, but there's a certain human limit. And so he gives some of the examples that Hobbes mentions, like you can't make somebody hate someone they love. That's one of the key examples. You can't make somebody believe something they don't believe. But he seems to draw, Hobbes acknowledges that, but keeps it kind of small. Whereas Spinoza thinks that this has got much bigger consequences. And the term at stake, this power you can't hand over, is potentia. And where for Hobbes we have jus, which is right, distinct from potentia, power, in Hobbes he says right is coextensive with power. So he sort of deflates the question of right down to just being the question of power. Okay, so that's a quick overview of, so he ends up with, in the TTP, with an account of starting from Hobbesian premises, he ends up defending extensive freedom of speech and freedom of religion within for a good political order. In the political treatise, he revisits these themes, less concerned with religion, but more in a general way, thinking of all different state forms, monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy, but unfortunately he dropped dead a few pages into the democracy chapter, which is interesting for an interpreter because you could then have a lot of challenges to work out what he really would have said in that chapter. Okay, so what Negri? So for Negri, Spinoza's first book is kind of good because it's overthrowing this juridical Hobbesian thing, which is just about you assert absolute power and you're fine, which you've heard from the earlier part of my book, is a caricature of Hobbes, but nonetheless, Hobbes may not have been reading Spinoza. So Spinoza may not have been reading Hobbes's latest work. He may have only been reading De Cive. He may not have been reading Leviathan. Anyhow, but Negri thinks that the real business happens in, he thinks that's just a liberal innovation there, where you're trying to think about limits on state power. The big change in Negri's view comes in the political treatise, where Spinoza starts to think about what is this power of the sovereign. The power of the sovereign is nothing but the power of the multitude. And then Negri mixes that up with, Negri takes this idea of the multitude as this sort of pre-political amorphous mass subject of politics, which, you know, supports any, is the basis for any political order. But if that, I think Negri's idea is, if that political order is not actually serving the needs and the interests of the multitude will eventually rise up against it. And Negri has this idea that the multitude, through history, even if it, you know, through history, it moves, each time there's a new form of potestas established, the multitude will overthrow that each time, reaching something more and more adequate to the needs of, you know, to the needs of this mass subject, the multitude. And Negri, you can see the heavily Marxist overtones here, right, of this reading of Spinoza. He thinks that this, unlike Marx's view of this as being just communism and you're there, I think Negri thinks that this is going to be a permanent process, because the multitude, he's very interested in how the multitude is not, it remains very diverse. And so he thinks that there'll never be like an end to this process, but certainly there is a direction to it. And so how does this link back to our questions of democratic? This is also linked in with Spinoza has this extremely difficult to understand doctrine in his metaphysics called the Conatus doctrine about how everything strives. And so I think that's also feeding in exactly what that means is highly contested, but Negri uses that idea to feed into this idea of this multitude pushing towards this democratic flourishing over time. Concretely, what does this look like? For Negri, the multitude, you see it in social movements, right? Again, this sort of maybe Marxist kind of flavor coming through. And so what the power of the people really is this power of the people upswelling when people go out and protest and overthrow ossified democratic institutions. And he thinks that there's something kind of, there's no need for institutional shaping of this direct, this is why it's radical, direct expression of the multitude. The multitude might itself temporarily set up structures, but basically it's a force of its own directed towards this sort of, the common good. So that's Negri's view. And I think that's an immensely appealing view, especially for a lot of social movements who know the history of the role of social movements in a lot of really significant social change and improvement and breaking down of barriers. They know that history. Then they feel their own sort of role in that. And so I'm not quite sure where to start. I disagree with this as a reading of Spinoza, and I disagree with it as a useful frame for democratic theory. But there's a lot of threads going into that. So I don't know, maybe I can pause which direction.
No, I mean, that's useful. I mean, yeah, I thought maybe we could talk about the textual side of things, and then we'll get into the, you know, the broader democratic implications to conclude. You know, on the textual side, I mean, maybe you could sort of walk us through sort of the, you know, again, the line about potentia, which you bring up as a sort of way in to challenge this reading, because you draw on Spinoza's Ethics, his metaphysical treatise, to start to develop a certain conception of, you know, see what this conception of potentia is that bears a lot in common with Hobbes, right?
Yes. Okay. So yes, let's go into these technical details. So the power of the multitude, potentia of the multitude, we have this weird sort of textual puzzle to work out exactly what this potentia is. And so on the one hand, in the politics, Spinoza says, look, right is coextensive with power. You know, the big fish have the right to eat the little ones. And it seems like, so that gives you one sort of idea of what the power is, which seems, but when we look at the ethics, power, Spinoza thinks about each thing's own power and talks about how for human beings, they're more powerless when they're swayed by the affects and pushed around by outside forces. And an individual is more powerful to the extent that they're more self-determining. And in the ethics, that's like determined by reason. And that way you don't get pushed around by these external forces. You actually develop your own reason. And that's the free man is the most powerful individual in the sense that, and because they understand the world, they understand their place in it. Bad things happen to them and they don't go flying off in a rage or anything. They've got things under control. And he thinks that also once you have this level of power, then you're ethical and virtuous in all of the fairly conventional kind of ways, because you understand that the way you understand that what it is to be a human being is to be very reliant on other people, and you should be nice to them, help them all to become nice and rational too. And this links to the Conatus or striving doctrine. The idea is that each thing, insofar as it's a very difficult thing to understand. It's something about each thing strives for to the extent it can for its own perseverance. And so this gives this picture in the ethics of, and that's what its power is, it's striving, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a teleology without teleology, really. I mean, it's
yeah, that, and that, look, that's a big question of exactly how that goes. I think, yeah, exactly how you put in or take out that teleology there. But one thing's for sure, though, in the ethics, you're talking about the more powerful individual, and the ethics is this nice, virtuous, ethical individual. And so Negri seems to have this idea, the same thing goes for this mass subject, the multitude, right? That it strives towards its own greater power over time, which isn't going to be this beautiful, egalitarian, democratic, nice kind of thing. Not the kind of messy domain of oligarchic power groups not necessarily improving over time, which is kind of what I painted as a picture in the Hobbesian chapters. And so I found this... This seemed to me a puzzle, and so Negri tries to put these two things together. But my textual contribution, I suppose, is to say that they actually come apart quite systematically, and so in particular, you realize that when you look closely, there's like a couple of different ways of talking about power, all potentia, actually. So for Spinoza, everything, all of nature is the same as God, all of nature, that there's the power of the whole of nature. And everybody in it is just part of that, right? Everybody's just within nature. And so when you talk in the ethics about an individual, So everything that acts, you know, anything that happens, it's always by virtue of external causes, because everybody's, you know, so many different little parts. You know, why did I get up today? Well, it was because I went to bed at a certain time last night, but why was I even born? And why was I even in this house? And there's 20 million different causal factors leading to any particular thing I do, because I'm not, Spinoza denies free will. It's like I'm produced by this whole causal web of nature. Okay, so how can I talk about my own power? And so it seems that in the ethics, he's interested in, even though everybody is ultimately entirely caused, you know, in this causal network, you still can differentiate some of the effects that the person produces as being more from their own nature than from the outside. Classic example, if I go punch somebody because I'm angry, that's partly from my own nature, but it's partly from the fact that something made me angry. Whereas if I'm the kind of person who doesn't, you know, something happens to me and I don't get angry, then I'm more in control, whatever I do is more in control of myself, right? So there's an idea that what it is to be more powerful is to be a little bit more in control of yourself, as opposed to just, on the flows of whatever chance thing pushes you around. And so Spinoza, it's not like you can jump at, like have some free will which totally jumps out, but he thinks that through cultivation, you can develop the kind of attributes that allow you to navigate the world a bit more on your own terms, because you can deal with disappointments and stuff without lashing out. So that's the main way we talk about power of the individual in the ethics. But there's a separate way you could talk about that same individual's power. You could talk about what they actually can do. So think of this angry person. They're the classic example of somebody who's impotent in that sense of the ethics, because they're not very determined through their own nature. But they are highly effective, right? They might be highly effective. They can cause all sorts of damage, right? And so, and I think it's this, I put this in a Spinoza's framework is there's one sense of power, which is through your own nature. Another sense of power is whatever effects you produce, regardless of whether it's from your own nature or not. And it seems it's this latter sense of power that is at stake in a lot of the political discussions. So when you talk about a state having as much right as it has power, that's talking about the, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter how bad and corrupt and all sorts of other things it might be able to produce a lot of effects, right? You think of, Yeah, or you think that there can be all sorts of terrible arrangements of things that actually produce a lot of effects. Now, you might read them. So, for instance, I mean, one example I have is like, you know, the administration in a colonial state can be very effective at doing all sorts of terrible things in the state. It's not really understood through itself. It's understood through this external imposition. So it's not powerful in the ethics sense, but it's highly powerful in the producing effects sense. Now, of course, for Spinoza, it is desirable that you reach that point of being self-caused, right? So that you are not just, so that you have some self-regulating system rather than just existing on the pressure from outside. But they're just distinct notions. The other ingredient that I, so that's one thing. One thing is there's two different notions of power going on, which I think Negri systematically combines. The other thing is, I think he's just Marxianizing this notion of striving. He's just saying, to say that there is a striving to the extent the thing is in itself, that's like, to the extent that you're good at self-determining, you are striving in that direction. But to the extent that you fail, that just means external forces overwhelmed you and there's no overall tendency. So I think there's just, he misreads inner teleology and smooshes together two different notions of power. Maybe I can connect that back to where this leaves us for democratic theory. I'm asking.
Yeah. No, please do. Yeah.
So, So for him, so if you go back to this ethics idea, what makes an individual powerful, human individual in this sort of ethical sense? It's not just that naturally through some sort of like an Aristotelian tendency, you just become, you know, you become more virtuous over time. It often goes terribly wrong, right? It often just stalls at a certain point. There's no particular guarantee of any particular development. But what makes it more likely to happen is if it's actually structured and scaffolded in various sorts of ways. So if you have a supportive social environment in which you live, if you read nice books like The Ethics, or if that's not to your taste, he also thinks lots of religious books are very useful like this. Stock your mind with also all sorts of models of good behavior. This is the way that you become that individual that, you know, this sort of obviously is the sort of desirable thing to be, but the way you become it is through this kind of self-structuring, both external positive scaffolding and this internal. So you can suppose you can imagine like pedagogy and social environment and internal self-development. It's a work, it's not a given thing. And so similarly, analogously, I try to show that for Spinoza, it doesn't matter, like saying that the power of the multitude is the power of the, the power of the multitude. That's an analytical fact that holds true for any regime of whatever sort. That's just to say, what is a sovereign except a certain way of, you know, certain way of thinking of a political order altogether? And the question of how to make that multitude, the multitude doesn't have some natural tendency towards goodness. You have to make it get there. And the way it makes itself get there is through developing its own forms of institutionalized regularities and practices that help it to maintain itself in a good direction. And that's a difficult work to do over time. I think Spinoza has some elements of this kind of left Machiavellian tradition where it's possible that one of the self-regulation mechanisms could be conflictual. You know, Machiavelli has this idea that, you know, the plebs of Rome, in order to get a good political order, they kept on like being rowdy in the streets and causing trouble. And that actually was part of what made the Roman political order so robust. So I think that's within the scope of what I'm saying, but I'm certainly not the case that it's naturally, you know, social movements are naturally pure and good and heading in the right direction. Or even if they do something good, often people in movements regret when, oh, the movement became, oh, you know, they all got co-opted and they all got so bureaucratic. It's like, well, that can be done in a bad way, but you can't maintain that initial fervor of feeling all together and being a good social movement indefinitely. You have to give it some structures at a certain point.
Right. Yeah. It reminds me again of these the contemporary populist discussions where it's about the purity of the sort of pre-political people, right, that erupts into the sort of corrupted institutional structure of politics or society or culture. I mean, any number of these things, depending on the populace that you're talking about. And so it often takes a kind of mythic character, right? That's what it sounds like to me. Whereas Spinoza, in your reading, which sounds to me to be right, is the, you know, that there's a sort of, you know, the people emerge through the structures. They don't exist prior to them, right? Do I have that right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I think so. Well, I mean, depends exactly what words you use, but the people as a meaningfully popular agent has to be constituted, right? I think over time.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So yeah. So I wanted to sort of step back then, you know, sort of ask the question, bring Hobbes and Spinoza together, because there are many ways. I mean, their conception of power sounds quite similar, the descriptive account of power. Yeah. Their normative goals are different. So is that, I mean, so on your reading, what accounts for the different, you know, Hobbes takes this path towards repressive egalitarianism from Potentia. Spinoza takes this path towards education of the citizenry, so towards a sort of democratic self-determination via Potentia. Is the difference Conatus? I mean, so maybe Negri has a point. Maybe it is, you know, the essential difference between, you know, Hobbes doesn't have a view Conatus. So what is it? What makes the difference? Yeah.
Characterize a little bit differently, maybe the end point for Spinoza, which is that I try to push in the ethics case, it ends up being very much education. But I think the political analog for that is not just education. I think it's really a lot of really boring institutional structures, like, how do you make sure people aren't too poor? How do you determine who makes the decisions? How do you, you know, all of these boring things about rotation of office and things like that. How do you think about the best way to situate your capital with respect to different cities? All of these incredibly sort of material, boring kind of things. I think his view is that they structure your everyday life, they structure your passions, and they structure your willingness to even enter into this sort of democratic, enter into some sort of positive relation with your fellow citizens. If you feel really aggrieved at your fellow citizens, you're not going to enter into this positive educative process. And so I think just to characterize a little differently, that I think there's a lot of room for all these institutional design. The big difference that I see, and in some ways Hobbes is on board with that too, in some aspects, right? He thinks that you need a lot of consideration of fairness of laws and make sure that, you know, there's the indigent aren't left out too much and so on. The big difference that I see is that Hobbes's idea is you have to prevent any possibility of pushback against the sovereign decision, even in a democratic order. And you do that by really trying to minimize collective formations within the body politic. Whereas for Spinoza, he seems a bit more sanguine about that, you know, that there's room for there to be, you know, multiple powerful towns, and there might be some productive friction between them. You know, there's room for there to be a little bit of that productive pushback against sovereign rule. And in fact, for him, it's like, well, you know, the sovereign's not some sort of god either. They're going to make dumb decisions, so it's helpful for them to have a bit of pushback as well, to make them make the good decisions. And so, what do I see the difference? I think there's a couple of levels of difference. Number one, I think they're coming from very different sort of cultures. I mean, I'm not very good on the deeper sort of intellectual political history of the Netherlands, but I gather they had a long tradition of decentralized rule. So and so I think that already gave a certain sort of fed a little bit into this sort of background plausibility of what's even possible for Spinoza, in a way that was not so much the case for Hobbes. I think in another sense, I think that, as I say, for Hobbes, he's got, in my view, this intellectual journey starts with this very uncompromising absolutist view, very confident view, which is only gradually is gradually sort of complexified later on by thinking, oh, it's trouble to think of the conditions of this absolute sovereignty. And I feel like it's almost like there's only so much distance he can travel from his starting point, whereas Spinoza coming at it with new eyes can push it even further. I don't know. I don't really think that, is it down to some deep difference of their sort of metaphysics and their conceptions of human nature? It's true that Spinoza is much more interested in the possibility of, is profoundly much more interested in the possibility of human self-cultivation. And actually that's his lead into politics. He starts of all interested in what is, how do we achieve blessedness? And that leads him into thinking, oh, wait a minute, you can't actually, not everybody's going to read the ethics. We have to have this political structures, and that's the space within which this individual flourishing can occur. So certainly, and whereas Hobbes evinces very little interest in this kind of thing, right? It's like he's interested in the virtues insofar as they relate to political success. And beyond that, just not very interested, right? So,
Yeah, Spinoza has, he's starting on this trend in the moderns, I think, towards a nobler conception of human beings. Machiavelli and Hobbes knocked us down a peg or two towards more brute animality. Spinoza's trying to recover some of that ancient nobility, right?
Maybe. But I think also, I didn't express myself very well when I was saying it's only so far Hobbes can go. I think for Hobbes, he spent so much time pushing for this idea of absolute sovereignty because his big problem is, if you don't have somebody in charge, there's going to be fighting. And that's kind of like ground zero for him. So there's got to be a final person in charge. Whereas Spinoza quite early on says, but, for this all to work, it's going to be messed up just as much if the single person in charge makes stupid decisions as much as if the people are fighting. And so he's sort of refusing that initial Hobbesian move that we can just fix everything with an absolute power. And I think, so I don't know. I don't know whether I quite, in some ways with Hobbes, you said this quite dim view of human nature. It's also quite, there's something kind of nice about Hobbes in that he's not concerned to prescribe so much about your inner life. I kind of find that quite nice. And he's just like, let's just talk about what we do need to do to live together. And I find that kind of appealing. I do think, as I say, I feel like I live under a Hobbesian system. I think it has definite downsides. And I'm just trying to think, is that somehow, in particular, there's a certain, Spinoza's very interested in the way in which if you try to over-regulate things, sometimes you'll succeed, but often the casualties are the most honourable, and the people with the most integrity often fall foul of that the most of all, because they're the ones who don't care the consequences. They're just going to say what they think is right. And I do see that a bit in Singapore. And so maybe that's a blind spot for Hobbes. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great place to stop, Sandra. Well, this has been a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking about Hobbes and Spinoza. And thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.